You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson and this is the Food Talk Show. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge, co-founder of Food Rush. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Sue. How are you doing?
Good. And Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Hello, Ollie.
Hi. How's it going?
It's going really well. Now, I'm really excited about this. So we're off in 2018 and I thought a little bit of a change with you two in the studio.
I'm getting worried already.
I'm going to question you. I've got a little food quiz.
I've had a cup of coffee.
I've got a little food quiz here. Ollie's looking distinctly nervous. I wanted to test your food knowledge, yeah, seeing as you're both so involved in... And I'm going to have a little competition. So I was going to see who...
Scores lowest.
Yeah, exactly.
I have not prepared for this.
I led the team in our office quiz who got the lowest points.
Well, you're obviously well prepared for this. So definitely. I'm going to ask you 10 questions.
Right.
So your first question is a nice, easy one to like get you in there.
Is it 10 questions each or is
no,
it...
No. You're both going to have to come up with the answers to this. So the first question is, name the popular drink that was invented by John Pemberton in 1886. Oh, don't forget this is radio. So you can't have silence, by the way, chaps.
So you have to talk through your thought process.
1886.
Were you born
I was not alive then, I have to say.
Well,
and I'm going to assume that it was a drink that's probably quite sugary.
I'm not giving you any. I have no idea.
Is it boozy? Can we do 20 questions?
Just give us an answer. Come on. Hedging your bets here, chaps. John Pemberton in 1886. It is radio.
Cold brew coffee.
There you go.
Definitely
and
not
your
that.
Answer?
And my answer is Gordon's gin.
Coca-Cola.
I was going to go with that. And I thought it's just too obvious.
Okay.
I said sugar.
Yeah. You went off to fly start and then you talked yourself out of it.
Yeah, you talked me out of it.
Okay, so the second...
I'm trying to stick with you on this.
It's a team effort.
We've only got an hour. If we start dragging that long enough, then Sue will basically get bored and want to move the programme on.
Okay, so the second question for our 2018 food quiz. What would a Scotsman do with a spurtle? No rude answers, please.
A spurtle?
Spurtle, yeah.
Stir something.
Getting there, yeah, nice and warm on
that
one.
Oh no, that was my answer.
Stir something, okay. And your thoughts on that, Ollie?
Prepare haggis.
No, it's actually for stirring your porridge.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Or you can stir stews and stuff like that. So stirring something is absolutely right. That's what a Scotsman
what
would do.
What century
with a spurtle.
Was the
no, you can get them
haggis
now.
Invented?
Oh, I don't know that. Do you know the answer to that?
I do actually, because it was in our
1800s.
It's been around
19th
a while.
Century. No, but I don't know.
Apparently the first century.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, now you both know this one for sure. Number three. What are devils on horseback?
They are lovely things wrapped in bacon.
Wrapped in bacon?
Kidneys, isn't it?
No.
It's a specific...
It's not sausages wrapped in bacon. It's dates wrapped in bacon, isn't it?
And your answer, Guy?
I thought it was something to do with kidneys.
No.
Do you? You're completely wrong. It's prunes,
generally.
Is it?
Yeah. Sometimes it's plums, but generally it's prunes. Yeah, prunes wrapped in bacon.
Well,
okay, number
well.
Four. Dates. Now, we're joined by our lovely guest here, who's a little bit of Italian heritage. So, Jeremy...
Hi there.
I'm going to introduce you in a minute.
Team,
you might
Jeremy.
Know this one. Well, you should do, but don't answer. Let them be embarrassed first.
This is terrible.
Which pasta translated means little tongues?
Oh, it's going to be for the pig-eared ones. I know that one.
We're not very good at this, are we?
No.
Little tongues.
Yeah.
I should probably know this based on the work we do with Brillo.
Yeah, you should, shouldn't you?
Maybe they don't. Yeah.
No, I've got nothing on this one.
No.
I don't have the answer either.
There you go.
See, this must be a really
thank
hard
you.
Quiz then.
It's not a hard
difficult
quiz.
Difficult questions.
It's not
thank you. That was really kind of you.
I don't
pretend you don't
questions.
Know the answer.
I don't. It's Little Tongues is a linguine, which if you think about it,
makes perfect sense. I was thinking of something that would be shaped like a tongue, but no.
No, linguine.
Ah,
okay.
That makes a lot more sense.
This is going really well. which citrus fruit predominantly grown in Italy is used in Earl Grey tea? And sometimes eau de cologne.
Bergamot.
Yes.
One.
Whoa, he's got one right.
Well, that's what I was going to say as well.
Yeah, right.
He was.
He was. Yeah. Okay. Question six. How many standard bottles of wine make up a Nebuchadnezzar?
12.
Sometimes you get that in, you know, champagne and Nebuchadnezzar. We're getting 12 here from.
I think it's six.
Guy. It's 20.
Wow.
20 bottles. That's 15 litres.
Wow.
Nebuchadnezzar, I know, that's good.
Have you brought one in for us to try?
No, I should have. Should I for the new year?
That would have been nice.
Okay, in which country did the dish chop suey originate? Now, you're a traveller.
Hong Kong.
And your answer?
I was going to say Hong Kong, but I'll go with China, just to be different.
It's America.
Oh, it's
American.
You
will know this one, yeah.
This is a really good quiz.
In which city is the Coleman's Mustard Museum?
You must know where Coleman's are.
Come on, you should know that. Where are Coleman's based? Famous.
Birmingham.
I'm thinking Norwich, but it's not. Is it Norwich?
Norwich. Well done.
We can just cut this whole thing out.
No, because it's just so brilliant because you're
bad at it. We've got two. You were going to say Norwich as well. You just meant Birmingham.
No.
I was just mixing it up a bit.
Okay, number nine. Thankfully, this is nearly over. Which animal's milk is traditionally used to make Roquefort cheese? Roquefort.
Sheep.
Yes, well done.
Yep.
Ewe's milk.
You look very blank.
I was thinking about a good Roquefort moment I had.
Now, I've deliberately put this in because you've travelled to South America extensively, haven't you?
Really, have I? Okay, good.
Haven't you?
I've been there. I've been to Mexico.
That's Colombia. North America.
Okay. In which South American country would you find the wine-producing region of Casablanca Valley?
Argentina.
The wine-producing region.
I would say Chile.
It's got to be one of the two, hasn't it?
Guy, you're right.
Two.
And frankly, you were dreadful. Well,
next week, we're going to bring back a quiz, especially for Sue.
No, I think we should. No, don't do that.
Did you know the answer to any of these before you came up with the questions?
Of course I did.
Googled impossible food quiz online.
Yeah. It wasn't that impossible. I didn't think so. Anyway, so I've just proved the fact that even though you're involved with food all day, you actually obviously don't know much about
it. It's a big, complex industry. There's many things to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We know some, but not
shall
all.
Shall we turn to our lovely guest, Jeremy? So this is Jeremy Hibbert Garibaldi. Great name, Jeremy.
Thank you.
I'm a bit upset that you didn't know about the linguine.
It was on purpose to
to make them look better.
Exactly.
Now, you have a French and Italian heritage.
Yes.
Hardly surprising then that you've got a real love of food with that background.
True. I grew up surrounded by grandmothers really passionate about food, and I think it's been always part of my life.
Very much so. But you didn't start out by doing that. You started out in anti-bribery, corruption, fraud investigation, international arbitration and litigation.
It's the logical stepping stone.
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit.
So,
why did you go into that?
I think it's, and we'll talk about it probably about what we do as of today, but it's all about having a social impact. And I was really into law and finance, and I was trying to see how these could help big companies doing better business. So I was spending most of my time in Africa, in DRC, into mining companies and food companies. And it was really, really interesting to see, first of all, how you can do business there and help them trying to find a way of doing a better business. And the correlation probably between, you know, what I was doing before and what I'm doing now is actually, I'm pretty convinced that Collective Food is also trying to have this kind of social impact in promoting independent food producers, people caring about quality and good food, generally speaking.
And Collective Food is an organization that you've set up?
We started about 3 years ago, initially as a B2C marketplace, so for end customers like us. We had a small operation outside London, making deliveries on a daily basis. And then we started working with some restaurants, and I really realized that the gap was even bigger in the wholesale industry and the difficulty for chefs and also restaurant managers to access good food. And it became my my main focus for the past year.
And by good food, do you mean food where you absolutely know where it's come from? You know, where it started out, what's been added to it, you know, and how it's got to you. Is that what you mean by good food?
Yeah, I think we don't want to be exclusive, like being only organic. It's really about where it's coming from, how it's produced. So we have kind of quality criteria we want food producers to try and follow. So that could be on not using chemicals or limiting the use of antibiotics, for example, but also knowing where it's coming from. And mainly I'm originally French and Italian, but I've been so surprised about the quality of food in the UK. I've been traveling.
In a good way or a bad way?
A very good way, actually.
Oh, yeah, really? Thank goodness.
That's hard to read.
That's a positive comment.
I was just about to eject him from the studio.
I've been very, very positively surprised. I've been traveling a lot around the country, trying to meet as many food producers as possible. And you have amazing food out there. And I think there is an issue on how accessing it easily. As a business,
finding
or
out
as
about
end
it
customers.
And sourcing it. Yeah.
And the role of your company is to help people understand the supply chain that product has been through. Is that correct?
So we mainly an online procurement platform for restaurants for them to connect directly with farms. So it's a tech company. How to improve the relationship between both sides, but part of this process is to really promote what the independent producers are doing. To kind of, you know, explain the process of the production, where the products are coming from, ensuring it's from the UK, all this basically. So,
Ollie, you represent a lot of chefs on Great British Chefs.
Yep,
there's a real crisis of confidence, isn't there, in terms of some of the things that have happened. I think people have been really shocked that they just don't seem to know where your food comes from. And even, you know, supermarkets don't even know. Is there sort of a post... you know, shock tremors going around, do you think, and people are really considering it?
I think people are beginning to ask bigger questions. And I think, you know, because the way you referenced organic in that conversation earlier was interesting, because I think actually it's about just trying to be visible about what the process is.
Transparent.
And I just
exactly
I think that
word,
bit yeah. isn't there. And I think that, you know, what people focus on is price often and product. And actually connecting those two worlds and trying to understand the journey that happens in that is really complicated. And I think that for a long time we've placed our trust in brands, retailers, suppliers, and have believed that that represents a kind of a gatekeeper to quality. But I think what became very clear in all the allegations surrounding the stuff that happened at Two Sisters, actually a lot of what was going on was not clear to anyone.
Is it fair for us to expect that a retailer is a gatekeeper, though? I mean, they've never really set themselves up for that, and yet as consumers, it was,
no.
I
but
think
when you say things
of,
like good food costs less at, you are putting a qualifier on that. You are suggesting, you know, you are ultimately saying these are my brand values of business. These are people I'm selling. You know, a retailer makes choices about what they are selling, and in my opinion. That if I, you know, if I'm making a choice to sell something, I'm putting my brand behind that.
Because if you look at Whole Foods, for example, Whole Foods Market, they say that they will check a whole bunch of criteria before they even list anybody. You know, whether it's got palm oil, you know, all those things, so that when you go through their door, you know that there's already a checklist for that. Don't you think that the British public assumed that was happening with the big supermarkets when actually it wasn't?
I don't. Well. I think the palm oil one is a specific issue,
yeah.
And I don't think that.
I didn't mean it in that much detail.
But I think that's what's interesting. I think, which is the question you have to ask is, what are the ethics of this business I am buying from, and do they align with my ethics? And that's kind of the fundamental question that the consumer has to ask, and ask the question. You know, so you know, Tesco's is clear about what their ethics are, and I think you know, I think in some ways, in some of the stuff that happened over Two Sisters. The question might be, were Tesco's being, you know, misled? Was M&S being misled? Was Sainsbury's, you know, who's being misled here? So I think there's some stuff. One has to delegate some degree of trust to the brands we work with, because life is so complicated.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on what area of the discussion you're having. So if you're talking from a food safety point of view, currently we're working with a big food safety organization, and they would say that one of the things that they talk about in terms of the retailers is that they're the last line of defense between the supply chain upstream and the consumer. So from a safety perspective, they have to, you know, almost be able to guarantee that food is safe. Now, of course, guarantee is a very strong word, and, you know, maybe I'm not using all the correct terminology from a legal perspective or what have you. But when you're talking about claims, things like, you know, health claims or, you know, ethically sourced or these certifications like, you know, fair trade and what have you, those are other different parts of the conversation. And I don't think that the retailers can be held responsible in all cases for, you know, what somebody puts on the pack. It's a very, as Ollie said, very complicated discussion.
But when they're inventing, like there's the whole story around, you know, people inventing farms and creating kind of farm brands.
Yeah, well, this has been in the news recently. Yeah,
and I think
I hate the way that graphics are used in photography to make you, and it never says it, but make you make the assumption that that's the farmer and that's his little barn in the background and those are his chickens, when clearly it's absolutely not. And they're not making that claim on the packet, but the visual aspect of it leads you to believe that. Now, I actually think that is immoral, actually, and unethical, but it happens all the time.
It's
all
certainly
the
not
time.
Transparent, and that's the word that we're using at the moment.
Which is why we come to Jeremy. Mm. So is it that sort of thing that just annoys you or you know, you felt somebody had to do something about it, particularly for the restaurant sector?
Definitely. I think a key point you've highlighted is the transparency part. And I think having all these intermediaries, being retailers or distributors or wholesalers, there's few issues with that. Is first of all, you most of the time don't know where the food is coming from or how it's produced, and you're kind of losing the direct connection with the farmer or the grower. That's why we're trying to actually get rid of these intermediaries somehow, in a way to make it more transparent, which means as a consumer, you can go straight to the source, learn about it, and make the decision of buying from them or not. So you're not relying on the brand or on the intermediary, you go straight to the source, and then you can make a proper decision about, you know, does it fit with my quality criteria, does it fit with my values, is it, you know, from the UK, all the things you need to actually make a proper decision.
God, do you remember when we had Patricia Michaelman on from La Fromagerie? She bought us the cheese. It was our favourite programme. Ollie wasn't here. It was our favourite programme
really
of all time.
Was it your favourite because I wasn't here or because of the cheese? Both. Or both, yeah. You got more cheese.
Exactly. Yeah. But she actually told us about every farmer, what the soil was. I mean, she knew. Now, she's obviously got the time to do that, and that's her ethics. And she's in the middle of Marylebone High Street, and she can charge what she wants.
And Highbury.
And Highbury, of course. But there's something amazing about that. She absolutely knows where it all comes from, what the quality is, and all that sort of thing.
And that's something also that her customer base will really come to love and trust her for as well.
Yeah, and want to talk to her about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the thing is, if you're a restaurateur, you haven't got time to do that, have you, Jeremy? You need somebody to make those connections for you, I guess.
Yep, and I think that's where technology can help, actually. And the way we've built our software is to let all these farmers and producers find a way to promote what they do and their story. So you have all the storytelling part, but also the quality part. If you have any certificates, awards, or things like that you would like to communicate about. To go back to the transparency again, I think the second point, which was really interesting, is the prices. And I think for so many years, the lack of transparency, it's also about all these intermediaries and the markups, right? So you don't really know what's the real wholesale price out from the farm, how much, you know, goes back to the farmer. And I think, again, trying to go direct means you have more transparency on the prices. If the prices are set by the farmers, the growers, the producers, when you're making this decision about do I want to buy from them, you know, that's their price. They're satisfied about it.
But Jeremy, what happens though if the price is too high? Because unfortunately, in Britain in particular, we are used to cheap, artificially cheap food.
So I think,
and there's a difficult. I mean, how are we going to hike that in a way?
I think we're going back to convenience, and I think even myself, when I go to supermarkets, you know, big supermarkets, sometimes I'm a bit frustrated of getting in there, but it's all about the convenience. And for years, big distributors or wholesalers, it's more about the shipping part and the delivery part. And I think what we've realized, and actually I have some case studies of restaurants we're working with, Because they're going direct, the prices are set by the producers. And we basically, the food goes from the farm straight to the restaurants. It doesn't spend days in big warehouses with waste, with inventory management, with thousands of people.
Or a middleman who's adding another layer of cost.
So you're removing 20 to 50% markups on prices. And so for most of our restaurants, they're accessing better quality food for a better price. And that's amazing for us. And that's what motivates us on a daily basis, because if you start reaching this kind of success, I think that's amazing.
And I think that, you know, there in some ways is a crisis of confidence going on in many restaurants, particularly in London, because rates are going up, rents are going up, people are feeling a bit more freaked out at the moment and therefore spending
less. It's harder to get staff, so you're having to
pay
more. Hard
to get staff. Mm. Prices are going up if you're importing things in, currency fluctuations. So I think this is a very real issue at the moment that people are concerned about. How do they maintain their profitability or even their sustainability of a restaurant? You know, and I think, you know, it's extremely, you know, keeping control of your P&L is, you know, as well as keeping the restaurant full is probably at the heart of it.
And if you cut the middleman out, is that sufficient to still allow you, you know, to buy something at a reasonable price just because you're cutting that middle bit out?
I think so, yes. Mm. Yeah. I really think so. When you're removing most of the markups, and you have this kind of direct negotiation with the farmer and the grower too, so you're creating long-term reliable relationships instead of just having a big distributor just trying to find the cheapest product for you or from different countries.
Yeah.
And you have leverage here. And usually as a farmer, you want, you know, these kind of long-term relationships where there's human beings beyond that and really relationships, which could mean better prices, which could mean better terms. I really believe in.
And
that.
Do you find that the restaurateurs or the chefs who are using the platform, do they continually buy from the same source? Do they discover somebody and then build a relationship there, or are they kind of always shopping around for the best price?
It's usually creating a trustful long-term relationship. That's what I've seen for multiple reasons. But when you start serving some chicken to your end customers, you want to be sure it's always the same size, shape, taste, you know, same quality of the meat. So it's usually starting the relationship and then it goes for a long term, which is very different from traditional distributors or big wholesalers, where you could have replacement products without knowing. They're lacking mushrooms that would be imported mushrooms from the US or other countries. So you're lacking the direct connection between people. And I think that's something we need more today.
And how does your platform work then? So there's presumably one side of it is for the producers themselves, and then the other side is for the restaurateurs or people in food service. So how does it work for, you know, what's the benefits on the platform?
Exactly. So it's like a two-sided marketplace. On one side, we're offering all the tools producers need to get more visibility. So it's to tell their story, to reach more people in London. So we're focusing on London right now. We're offering them services like credit checks, insurance. Our sales team is on the ground promoting their products. So it's really full, you know, full package of services for them to get more visibility and hopefully get more sales. On the other side, it's pretty straightforward. As a restaurant, you can go on the platform, browse all these amazing producers and products and start making orders directly with them.
And you're not involved in any of the fulfillment. It's purely you are connecting the two sides.
Yes. So either the producers have the delivery capacities or we have a fulfillment partnership that just take care of collecting the products, delivering them. There is no storage, no manipulation of the goods. You know, when it's leaving the farm, it's the products as they should be, properly packed straight to your restaurants.
And how do you gatekeep the good producers? You know, make sure that they're okay and as transparent and doing the things that they say they're doing.
As of today, we're still early stage. It's mainly declarative. So we have a quality criteria you need to agree to whenever you want to be part of our collective, our company. Then you can, of course, try the food as a chef or as a restaurant. You can order some samples. All the certificates, certifications, awards are available on the platform. on the long term, I want to implement some ratings and hopefully actually
some reviews that people can post.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it becomes self-policing in essence.
Somehow, but
it'd be very difficult otherwise. If you never touch the product, then you can't put a quality control in place, and so it has to be, you know, something that's very challenging to manage, I guess, when you're that kind of effectively a middleman, but you're the facilitator is probably a nicer way to put it.
But your community on Food Rush, it's something they're very concerned about, isn't it? Is this traceability and how do I make these choices and how do I know this thing's okay and it is what it says it is?
Yeah, and I think it's challenging. I mean, a lot of the people that we work with, a lot of the brands and organisations that we work with, they're these, you know, ethical or sustainable or organic or locally produced. We're trying to, you know, support as much of that as possible. And then our audience, our community, they're just normal people who love food and they, you know, they want something that's good for themselves and good for the planet as well.
Mm. I mean, I have more time than I used to, so I've got the luxury of time, but, you know, I just won't buy meat in a supermarket anymore. They've lost my trust, actually. I've lost faith in their ability to actually supply good meat.
And it's tough because it's affordable for so many more people. And yet the quality is poor. They inject the chicken breasts with water to make them look bigger.
Let alone all the other stuff.
I mean, it's crazy. You know, go to a supermarket and you can pick up a chicken breast for what? I don't know, £1 or something. And then you go to one of these, you know, maybe it's online, maybe it's a farmer's market, and you're paying £5-6 per portion. Mm. It's prohibitively expensive for so many people, which is a real challenge.
But the interesting thing, though, is that there are brands, you know, that have entered and are in the meat space that are trying to provide, you know, higher confidence levels. So, you know, you take a brand like Gressingham Duck, who are, you know, they are the suppliers of duck in the UK, you know, UK family-owned business based out of near Ipswich. And, you know, they are, you know that you are buying from a branded good. It's not just the commoditization, it's duck. Yeah. I don't know, where's the duck from?
They're not sourcing it from all around the world.
Exactly,
in one place.
Here is Gressingham's duck. So you at least get to look at a brand. And that, for me, is one of the problems with some of the meat in the supermarkets is it's very unclear. So I bought, for example, the other day, Daylesford lamb from Ocado, right? Now, I know it's Daylesford. I understand the Daylesford brand. You know, it's good quality lamb. And, you know, they've obviously got their butchers in-house and they're careful about their brand. So, you know, you've got heirs of trust. But for me, it's the sort of the big, you know, kind of...
I mean, if you get a slice of ham, you know, that sort of processed ham, not only will it not be from the same pig, it could be from different pigs from different countries in one slice of ham. You know, that's what we're talking about.
It doesn't sound right, does it?
But some of it's down to, you know... Interesting. I think it's basmati rice, where the definition of basmati rice is that it's 90% basmati.
90%, yeah.
Right, so, you know, so you're like, well, hang on, no, basmati rice is basmati rice. So, you know, we work with Tilda. Tilda's 100% basmati rice. But when you talk to them, you say, well, hang on, what's basmati rice? They say, well, in retail environments, it means 90%, basmati rice. So you've got that kind of, you know, total... You know, I think part of this stuff is down to the rules in the industry. Part of it's down to kind of the way that things are organised and the way the rules are built in the game, which allows people to mess around and, you know, but also that leads to an erosion of consumer confidence. It leads to, you know, more and more questions. Well, if that happens in that category, you know.
It's like when you do sausages and they say it's got 70% meat, that's allowed to include sinew and this and that and the other, you know, whatever. And we would all think that meat means, you know, something that comes off the leg or the belly or something. Yeah, so you've got to understand the rules, haven't you, about what meat means, because it doesn't necessarily mean the thing that you do. And the way they reclaim meat, you know, off chickens and things like that.
Mechanically reclaim meat.
I don't want that to be called meat.
Crazy thing. Yeah.
It should be called something else, so at least I know, you know, what is meat and what isn't. So it's all fraught with difficulty. So we're going to have a little break now. Fascinating subject. I think more and more people are going to want to know where their stuff comes from and maybe go direct. But you know, distribution is an issue and finding these people is an issue. So it's really interesting to see what Jeremy's doing. So let's have a little break and we're back in a minute. It. Just coming to the end of the day at Food Matters Live. I'm a little bit tired, actually. And I have to say, you wouldn't believe this, but I'm actually quite grateful to have two lovely guests in front of me and I don't have to eat anything because I feel a little bit sick. So I wandered past this stand that's called Gerald McDonald, and very unusually here, this company I think is about 100 years old, and I'm joined by Kevin Knight and Maxim McDonald. Maxim, tell me a little bit about the history of the company. Is it your family who started this?
Yes, it was. Back in 1917, my great-grandfather set up the company, so we're celebrating our 100th anniversary this year. And we originally started out as a spice merchant, or he did, in the city of London, back when spices were very much exotic commodities. And eventually, when my grandfather took over in the 50s, we moved into juices. There was a great government push in the 50s to get kids drinking orange juice for the vitamin C. And
now they're telling them not to drink it, yeah?
Yeah, how things, how times change. And so we're now in juices and spices.
So just sort of conjuring up a picture of 100 years ago, you know, boats would sail in to the UK, you know, places like Liverpool, and they'd be loaded with spices. I mean, some of those things were incredibly valuable. I mean, almost as valuable as gold at the time.
Yeah, pepper used to be worth just about as much as gold.
There was still the expression of peppercorn rent. And then you have the cloves, which were still used in medicinal purposes, and then you have the nutmeg wars in Indonesia with the Dutch for many years. And you had the travellers would go across and bring back these things, and no one had ever experienced them before.
And you can imagine having a sort of very bland diet, possibly not if you're rich, obviously, but, you know, just normal people. And then to have something that exotic would literally blow your head off in a way, not just in terms of heat, but in terms of taste that people just would not be used to. And it would have been incredibly novel.
That's right. And I mean, this is also part of where we are now with everyone has a product and a product that they're looking to enhance in some way. And one of the natural progressions will be adding a bit of spice to it again, or a bit of herbs, or a blend, or a mix.
Or a colour, even.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess what you're saying is that actually it's not really that different from 100 years ago. That search for novelty, for something that somebody else doesn't have, and actually probably being the first to the market and then arriving with it on a boat would be, you know, you'd be almost like a rock star, wouldn't you? You doing that here. And we're at Food Matters Live today. And actually, it's still a search for novelty, isn't it? Do you think that, Maxim?
I think so. I think in the old days, well, with spices at least, it was used more to sort of hide the natural taste of products. But now it's more used to sort of make them more exciting. And we're always trying to taste something. We're very adventurous in the UK. There's a lot of change happening all the time. So in a show like this, you see that quite clearly.
So in your company, you started off as a spice merchant. I've just been over to your stand earlier today, and you've got lovely little pots of all these different, you know, different sort of ingredients. What are you actually seeing, Kevin, at the moment in terms of trends? Is there any ingredients that you're seeing at the moment?
Turmeric. Yeah. Everyone is looking for a higher percentage of curcumin. It's got exceptional different health properties across the board. Chilies, cayenne, paprika. If you take just the normal crisps or popcorn or any of these snack foods now, everyone is looking for a different flavour combination. If you want to start to get a little bit more exotic, they're putting things like Szechuan pepper, or everything has a provenance, so they can put the name of it on the pot.
If we take popcorn, for example, there are now so many popcorn manufacturers and so many popcorn brands, you don't even know where to you know, start. And therefore, the only differentiator is coming up with something exotic in terms of a blend in order to make you stand out.
Yeah, I think so. And this is where we are sitting in this industry. And we're very happy to look at bespoke options for people and flavour combinations. I think also, as the world has got smaller, people have travelled a lot more. And on that basis, they want the flavours that they've tasted in the countries that they've visited. And Yeah, how can they do it? You go down in the supermarket aisle, you're going from one continent to another continent to another. You know,
it's incredible, isn't it? Gerald MacDonald and Company Limited has been going for 100 years. You're based in Basildon. I think you've got 40 or 50 staff, something like that. Yeah, what exactly does the company do?
Well, there's the trading side, which is now 100 years old, where we do both trading business to business in juices and spices. So we deal in bulk quantities. So we work mainly with food manufacturers and bottlers who will then sell on to retailers and supermarkets. And we also have blending facilities in Basildon, which was the reason why we moved out of the city in 2000, both in juices and spices again. So for this, on the spice side, we do our own curries. We're now starting to do more seasonings as well. And that's we have a lab as well where we're always looking at NPD and new products.
So somebody might say, you know, I want to make carrot juice or something. Get me a load of carrot stuff in. I'm obviously being hugely generalising. But actually, what you can do is source the ingredients, as well as somebody saying to you, look, I've got these crisps or this popcorn. I really like pepper, but I like a bit of lime, and I like, you know, can you help me make that ingredient? So you do both those things?
Yeah, it works normally two ways. Either a customer has an idea of what they want already, so they'll have a recipe and they'll come to us and ask us, can you blend that juice for us, that compound or juice blend for us? And we can work with them on that, or we can work with them by they have an idea but they're not quite sure how to do it. So they'll come to us for advice of how much they need of each ingredient, and we can recommend what's best.
So you're not a contract manufacturer. You're not going to make the popcorn for them. But what you would do is you would make the blend of the flavouring for them, so that when they go to a contract manufacturer, they've already got that sort of thing sorted.
Well, yes, the juices are already processed from source. And then what we do is we just blend them, and they're ready to send to the bottler who can then bottle them and maybe add citric acid or some sort of sweetener their end.
But you really play around with it. You've got like a chemistry set where you're mucking around and doing all that. So Kevin, how does that work in the company? Have you got specific people who work on that, or do you all chip in, or how are you set up?
I mean, there's a lot of experience within the company. I mean, personally, I've been in this business, and my father was trading spices for many, many years, 47 years to be precise. And so it's knowing the products themselves, which then enables you to help the customer decide what combinations will work together. It is a little bit like a sort of, as you say, a boiling pot of mixtures and putting them together. I mean, that's a very simplistic side of it. But we are finding that, so many more of these customers. Well, you can break it down into different areas. So you've got the bakery industry, for instance. So they will predominantly look at this, like the nutmegs, the cinnamon, the cloves, there's very sweet sides to enhance their products. Or you might look more at the meat industry. You know, I remember you would get one sausage when you walked into, but now there are many, absolutely, many, many chilies, you know, herbs and spices and blends within them. So things are changing in that. The food industry is very large.
It's quite exciting times. I think, as you mentioned earlier, the British are actually pretty good at trying stuff. You know, they're not, they're quite traditional in some ways, but they're really quite good at trying things. I think the downside of that is they're also quite fickle. So once they've tried a few things, you know, and that becomes their favourite, they might then move on to another thing. And in the food industry, you've just got to be on your toes all the time, haven't you?
Yes, that's right. And within Gerald MacDonald, of course, we're looking at other niche areas. One area that we've got promoting here is a Japanese, it's called Sancho green pepper, and it has many layers, so it has a pepper.
Is this the thing you made me taste earlier?
Oh,
I can't explain it. It's the most bizarre thing. I mean, what are you going to do with that? Because it's the most incredible ingredient.
Well, I mean, because of the price of it, it's at a different level in some ways, but for the restaurant trade, and also for distillers and gin manufacturers, a lot of that area, you've tasted it, I mean, you don't need an awful lot to get the same flavour.
So let me just explain what you're talking about here. I think you told me it's £150 a kilo. Have I got that right?
That around there, depending on exchange rates. And
£150 a kilo. Anyway, so it's like a tiny peppercorn. It's not been dried. It's natural, and it's a green colour, quite a bright green colour. These guys made me taste one, and I tasted it, and initially it tasted like a pepper, you know, as you would expect. Then I got this real heavy citrusy thing that came through, and then afterwards it completely anaesthetised my mouth as if I was at the dentist.
Yeah, it's very high in limonene, and so yeah, it's a flavour combination. I mean, not
it's for the most anybody. Bizarre thing I've ever tasted.
But yeah, it is lovely.
So what are you going to do with that? I mean, I think one of the guys I was talking to, one of your technical guys there, was saying that actually it's almost like an anaesthetic, and actually could be incredibly useful in that, you know, if you're tasting these, you know, a meal and you maybe have five or six courses, to have that in between courses would literally clear your palate and neutralise stuff. So that when you taste the next thing, you're tasting it from zero base, and you can really taste the flavours. You know, how would you take a product like that and do something with it?
Well, I think in the traditional Japanese culture and cuisine, it is used in that way. So for the courses that they prepare, you will have it within the course that then cleanses for the next course and that sort of thing. But it still has this very unique, they call it a magical spice.
It's a bit weird. It's a bit drug-like.
Did you find it pleasant, though, that sort of tingling sensation?
Yeah, I guess I did. To me, it's a bit like what you feel like after you had a shot of alcohol. Yeah. You know, it gives you a bit of a... Just, I don't know, does something to your body. It gives you a bit of a hit.
Jury's still out on that one.
But you had it in its raw form, yeah, of course, you know. Yeah.
Blimey. Yes, well, we'll look out for that, and I'm sure we'll be back on the show when that ingredient actually reaches the mainstream and gets sort of built in into products. But in the meantime, I guess if anybody's looking at somebody to help them with flavour combinations, you know, to help them source ingredients that they're struggling with, it's GeraldMcDonald.com, and you work with food businesses all over the country.
Yeah. And not just large companies, we work with the startups as well, small companies, one-man bands, people who are just starting out who want to sort of get an idea of what they should be doing if they want to sell a new drink or get a new seasoning out there. And we've got lots of samples as well. We're very good on samples and being able to sort of cater for all sizes of companies.
Well, fascinating. I mean, for me, it's almost the secret underbelly of food production that nobody actually knows about, the companies like yourself. But actually, it's a really important part of the food sector and getting these new and interesting flavours out. So, Kevin, thank you very much for joining me, Kevin Knight and Maxim McDonald. And if you want to find out more about the company, if you go onto our foodtalk.co.uk website, we'll have loads of information there, and we can direct you straight to their website. But thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've joined us at a very good time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Our savvy software development guys have just qualified for a chunky government cash payout, thanks to our new friends from Breakthrough Funding. Yeah. Sorry, that just slipped out.
Government handout.
No, not a handout, but recognition for our clever thinking. Now it'll be down to you to help us kick it further forward.
Leave it to me.
Your company could qualify for Innovation Cash too. Find out online now by answering just 6 qualifying questions at breakthroughfunding.com. Yeah!
And there you have it. Now we're back in the studio. I have Jeremy Hibbert Garibaldi. Still one of my favourite names of all time.
Great.
From Collective Food. And, of course, I've got my co-presenters, Ollie Lloyd and Guy Routledge. And if you've got your name then, Guy.
It's a tricky one, I'll give you that.
Ollie, we're just going into 2018 now. You've just had some crowdfunding. Not for your business, you've had some crowdfunding for a cookbook.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
It's correct, yeah.
How did it go?
Well, it's been really interesting. So we were sort of looking at ways in which we could build out our brand and do interesting stuff with our community. And we sort of thought that it was time we published our first cookbook. And we were in a conversation with our board, and one of our board members said, well, yeah, I know we could self-fund this, but wouldn't it be much more interesting to actually put the community at the heart of it? And we sort of went, oh, okay, let's go away and look at that. And so we decided to try and raise, we set a target of £60,000 on Kickstarter to fund the creation of a cookbook. And we decided to do it differently by saying to the audience that, you know, you would be able to recommend and choose which recipes of ours you wanted in the website. So we literally said to our community,
crowdsourced as well as crowdfunding.
Absolutely. So the community have the right to comment on which recipes they wanted. That was the idea. So we put it up there, and within about 11 days, we hit our £60,000 target. And we ended up raising about £108,000 in the end.
Nice work.
And why do you need that amount of money then? Because, I mean, you know, I would imagine that printing a book maybe costs a couple of pounds a copy or something like that. Why do you need that much money? Are we just going on holiday?
So, no, sadly not. It's basically, I mean, the work really goes into the production of all the recipes and the testing of all the recipes and all the sort of photography of all of it and the creation, the design, the delivery of it. So that's quite a large chunk of cash to sort of lay down that. And then obviously what we want to do is create something, you know, truly wonderful. So we're really sort of investing time and energy to make sure that we've got this sort of beautiful cookbook that tells the story of Britain's chefs and what's happened.
And so, specifically British chefs then.
Yeah, so we've divided the book into a series of chapters. The first one about the masters, the guys who really created the revolution in the 70s and 80s and have sort of led that. We then look at, you know, things like the French chefs in Britain, then we go into the European chefs, then we look at the influence of Asia, and then we look at the evolution of the pub chef, and then we look at the future and where that's all going. So we've got a kind of a structure that sort of tells a story.
So it's almost historical, really, in how it's all changed and evolved.
Yeah, it tries to editorialise what is great British food. And obviously we're in a very unique position of being, you know, very close to all these guys and girls, and we're able to talk to them about how food has changed and what's going on.
And that doesn't mean to say that they were born in Britain, but they're working here and they've got restaurants here.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've always believed that Great British Chefs was about the people who were in this country, not from this country.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that probably makes the British food scene as exciting as it is that actually it's people from all over the world who are coming here to create great food and to work with the amazing produce that we have. And we're very lucky to have such a culinary melting pot. I mean, it truly is extraordinary.
I think we are blessed in that respect. In terms of photography and stuff and how you're selecting the recipes, are you using, as you say, your sort of people who visit the website and all that sort of stuff for them to influence what you're going to do in terms of recipes? And then how do you do the photography? I mean, are there specific photographers who just do food, or have you got your mum to do it or something?
So we work with a lot of photographers all over the country and all over Italy, because we also do great Italian chefs, and we get those people to help us to create this book. We want a very, you know, we've got 4,500 recipes on our website, so we wanted every recipe in this cookbook, which would be about 110, to have a similar style. So we're re-photographed. While we have an image for every single one of those recipes, we want to create one look and feel for the whole cookbook. And we're doing supper clubs to launch the event, or to launch the cookbook.
And how are you choosing the recipes? Is it the ones that are the most used on your website, or is it just...
So the backers of the project have recommended particular recipes they really like, and then we've looked at, because obviously you don't want to have, you know, loads of scallop recipes, or duck recipes, or dessert recipes. So we're trying to create a sort of curated group of recipes that will contain the whole spectrum from, you know, Pierre Kaufman's classic pig trot recipe that he used to serve at La Tonclair, through to someone who's pushing the boundary, like, you know, Paul A. Young, and has, you know, left the world of kitchens and now runs one of the great kind of chocolate brands. We're trying to span the whole kind of the world and look at all the different lenses on you know, how food has evolved. So the recipes we're picking are designed to tell part of the story. So if we're doing the reinvention,
so you've got a framework, and then inside that you're filling that with people's
I mean, it's been great favorites. Fun. The content team who work in our business have proposed the 110 recipes, and over the last few days I've literally been going through the recipes. And because we've got 4,500 recipes, there are lots of recipes, as you can imagine, that I haven't cooked, some that I haven't even seen on the site.
Really?
So I'm just like, oh, wow, that's a really cool recipe. Maybe I'll do that one for Christmas. Yeah. So it's been a really lovely journey, and going back to old favorites and going, I remember cooking that for the first time. And I think, even though, you know, we're an unapologetically digital business, people like physical things. And, you know, my cookbooks,
especially good photography. And, and it's a real art to be a food photographer because, you know, how are you going to do steam? It's quite difficult. Often in a studio, it's very, very hot and yet you've got something that might melt really quickly. If you get something and it just gels slightly, you know, you get a sheen on it so you can't then photograph it. Getting the colours right. I mean, it's you know, food it's photography so is very skilled. It's incredibly skilled.
We don't do what a lot of the big shoots will do. So when you see stuff on, you know, massive billboards outside, most of that food is completely inedible.
Oh God, yeah, you know, absolutely. They will spread it,
spray and crazy stuff. Yeah. We act. What's amazing is because we work with Britain's greatest chefs and food writers and food influencers. Actually, all the food put on the plate basically looks amazing, and because we've got the right lighting and the right cameras, actually, the hard work is done by the chefs.
Yeah.
Now there are certain things that are impossible to photograph and to make look pretty. But, you know, we do our best in
that. I remember doing a sort of event with Keith Floyd. I love Keith Floyd. He's hilarious. So I spent 24 hours, well, no, it was more than 24 hours, which was really difficult because we had to literally just guard him the whole time to make sure he was sober. But he was cooking some stuff. He did a breakfast thing for us and he was cooking it and we had people watching and it was a little bit of theatre and all that. And then afterwards I said, oh, can I taste it? He said, oh, Christ, no, don't touch that. It'll poison you. Because actually what he was doing is he was cooking as theatre, and it wasn't a tasting thing. Mm-hmm. But he said, oh, God, no, don't touch that. It'd be absolutely disgusting.
Well, the fact is are cooking for those demos, you can't take, you know, if you do you really want to watch someone sit there and, you know, cook down onions 20 minutes, for 25 minutes.
No, of course no. So he would. He was absolutely hilarious. But as you say, it's a completely different thing, isn't it? About, you know, why you want to do that food. I'm always quite interested in these cookery programs because I'm sure half of what you see you couldn't possibly eat, actually.
And sometimes it is quite funny at the end when they do the tasting to watch the face of the presenter. They're going, lovely.
Yeah, but
it's not because it's been sitting there for 20 minutes.
Yeah, can I just ask that question? You know MasterChef, when they have all those people, especially at the beginning when they've got about 8 contestants, and they all come up and then it's tasting. How can they possibly do that? I mean, it must be frozen, and therefore how can you judge, if you're that person at the end, whether that food was any good or not?
I believe the way that they judge it is based on what they've seen earlier. I did some...
they don't actually taste it.
Yeah, I did a day with Monica Galletti, who was one of the MasterChef judges. She was lovely, actually.
She looked scary, yeah.
And she was saying, it's a nightmare. And you end up eating so much of the same stuff all the time. And, it's not warm by the time they get to taste it.
Awful.
It must be really, really challenging.
I don't see how they can judge when actually they're not eating it. You know, I think
you can tell by it. If you watch the way things are being cooked and you look at the technique and you look at the way the stuff is being produced, you basically know flavour combination. I mean, that's why you've got people like Marcus Waring, you know, judging MasterChef professionals, because he can look at the way a dish is prepared and go,
he'll know.
That's going to be disgusting or that's going to be delicious. And obviously, there are obviously times when he is surprised by it. But fundamentally, you do know whether something is going to taste good. But I think, I mean, my sister's a series producer and she's about to do the new Mary Berry, which should go on, actually. She's doing the new Mary Berry series. And, you know, these are full-on days where they've got to get out unbelievable amounts of stuff in, you know, the most crazy amount of time. And, you know, it's all about getting it right on camera. And it doesn't matter, actually, what it tastes like in your mouth, because no one ever knows that. That's probably you need the right facial expression probably at that moment. But it's... We should get her on to come and talk about behind the scenes.
That'd be really
fascinating.
In the
world of TV.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, there you have it. All that's the lowdown on MasterChef. Just behind the scenes, Keith Floyd as well, and your new cookbook. How do we get hold of your new cookbook, and when's it going to be ready? I mean, it's not something that's just ready in you know 4 months, is it? Preparing a big cookbook,
shipping it, and the rest of it. So. So we're basically producing it at the moment. If you do visit, you probably miss the boat by the time by the time we're out there. So we're looking at doing a second edition because we think the first edition, which will be very much for the Kickstarter backers and the people who backed the project and were actually at the heart of kind of creating all the product and choosing the recipes, That's the first edition, but we're looking to do a second edition that we're probably going to sell as well through the chefs who are in it and a wider audience.
So when will the first edition be available to buy?
The first edition won't be available to buy. First edition will just go straight to the people who back the project.
Oh, I see.
Gotcha. And then the second edition will probably be available for next Christmas.
Gotcha. Oh, so there is a good reason for being part of there the is, investment.
There is. Yeah.
Okay, very good. So I'd like to say thank you to Jeremy Hibbert Garibaldi. And if you want to know much more about this really great idea, I think, in terms of connecting straight from the restaurant, straight from being a chef to producers, you need to go to collectivefood.com. So that's collective without the E, then food.com, or just go on to our Food Talk website and you'll find it. And thank you very much for joining us, Jeremy.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Did you learn anything about the quiz there? You couldn't answer any either.
Linguini, probably.
Linguini. Yeah, linguini, that's about it. So you've been listening to the Food Talk Show, and we're syndicated everywhere, I think, as far as California to the Kent coast. And I'd like to say thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of The Food Rush. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you.
And won't bother asking you any food questions in the future. And Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Thank you, Ollie.
You're welcome.
If you want to recommend any future guests or you know somebody's doing something groundbreaking, do get in touch with us via Twitter on at Food Talk Show. And if you'd like to listen to one of our hundreds of podcasts, please go to foodtalk.co.uk. Happy New Year to you and have a good week. We'll be right back.